I always try to be the best at whatever I'm doing. And if I'm not, I still tell myself I'm the best. You gotta believe it, right? I mean...
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Body Serve. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm James.
We've been back in Toronto for almost a week now. We just finished watching the men's final. Yesterday, one Danielle Rose Collins scored the biggest win of her life in her final season on tour. And today, Yannick Sinner continued doing what Yannick Sinner has been doing for the last few months.
Mm-hmm.
We promised other reactions to our time on tour.
On tour.
To our time at the tournament. And wow, our last day on site really delivered content for this segment.
Yes.
But we're going to leave the negativity, spoiler, it's negative, to later in the episode. And we're going to start with just the wonderful story that developed these past 10 days with Danielle Collins.
You saw Danielle early in the tournament against Avanesyan, is
yes.
that right?
I have this thing when I'm at tournaments where I always feel like I'm going to innocuously, just inadvertently see the winner. It's happened before.
Like just by accident?
Yeah, somebody you don't expect to be winning this tournament. It happened with Vondrousova in Berlin, but for Wimbledon, if that counts.
Oh, fair enough. It was just a few weeks later.
Yeah, so I'm on grandstand, and I was only there because I got in line to see Andy Murray on Butch Buchholz, and I said, F that.
Mm-hmm.
I could not be arsed. He was about to go down 3-love, and I said to myself, I just don't have this in me, even if it's maybe the last time I get to see Andy Murray. Surprisingly, to me, you...
Somehow I got in, and I'm typically not very persistent in situations like that. I'll give up because I really can't be arsed fighting with people and clamoring to get on a court.
We had just watched a set of Naomi and then grabbed a bite to eat. And you told me you were going to go see Sinner on Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went off by myself to go try to get into Andy. And you were trying to get into a different entrance. When I gave up, I went to grandstand and saw Danielle Collins just completely obliterate Avanesyan while I was overhearing all the drama that was going on in that Andy Murray right. match.
We'll talk about that in a little while. But like you said, you always happen to see the eventual champion when we're on site at a tournament. I don't know how. Even last year in Toronto, we didn't even go to a day of competition. We just went for the practice weekend and spent about an hour with Yannick Sinner. And I remember leaving thinking like, he looks okay, you know.
I thought he looked worse than okay.
And then, I mean, that's kind of what kicked off this incredible run, 6 titles since August, starting with that Canada title. But back to Danielle. Of course, as you know, Danielle announced that this would be the final year on tour for her. She is 30 years old. She's a 2-time NCAA champion. She's had a non-traditional career, right? She's had a short career. She broke out in Miami 6 years ago. And after, you know, a lot of health issues, a lot of incredibly high peaks and valleys, she has decided this will be her last year.
At just 30 years old.
But what a way to go about your final year.
The tournament where you announce yourself to the world 6 years ago, it's your home tournament. You tell the story in the winner's speech, an all-timer winner's speech. Not in terms of quality necessarily, but time.
No, but it was so thoughtful and it was so intentional to thank
yes.
everybody she could think of at the tournament and do it in a meaningful way.
Yes.
You know, these are the reasons why I'm grateful for you.
But in that moment, she told the story of her father and wanting to attend tennis tournaments, and this one specifically. And he said, you're only attending a tennis tournament if you're playing. And so here she wow. is at her home tournament, having the biggest win of her life in her final year, where it all started.
It felt kind of harsh, but it worked.
She's not one of those silver spoon,
no,
well-fed Nepo babies in tennis. You know, this is a middle-class woman from a middle-class background who went about things the unconventional route in tennis.
And we should say that in America, middle class means something very different than in the UK. It doesn't mean posh.
Okay.
Throughout this tournament, she opens against Para, drops her very first set of the tournament, and then doesn't look back. Doesn't drop another set.
And outside of the final against Rybakina, none of those sets were close. Not a one.
No, not particularly challenging matches. There was Potapova, Avanesyan, Kirsteya, Garcia, who had just beaten Osaka and Goff back-to-back, and a lot of people were looking at Garcia's form and were really impressed. I knew that there was a collapse coming because...
Because you're a nasty person.
Yes, that's why. And then Alexandrova in the semifinal, who had just beaten Iga Świątek.
Seven match wins. She won seven matches in these 10 days. Potapova, 2-2. Avanesyan, 1-2. That's the one I watched. Kirsteya, 3-2. Excellent work there. Excellent. Again, 3-2 over Caroline Garcia. 3-2 again over Alexandrova. And then in the final against Rybakina, 7-5, 6-3.
And Rybakina, for her part, really had to fight to get to this final. Hers was a less conventional run to the final, going three sets in four of her six matches.
She didn't look particularly well the entire tournament. To me, I may be misreading things or being completely idiotic in saying that, but it didn't look like a full throttle Rybakina at this tournament.
Well, she has been unwell. She had reportedly GI illness. She pulled out of Indian Wells, right, where she was the defending champion. But where she has showed up this year, she's played really well. She's been very consistent. Starts out against Townsend, a long three-set tussle, then against Townsend. Gets through Maddie Keys 6-3, 7-5, which was the inverse of the final score, basically. Maria Sakkari acquitted herself very well in these past two tournaments. A really impressive match against Rybakina.
She could have won that match easily. Well, not easily. Well, not. It would have been very difficult, but she could have just as easily won that match as did Rybakina.
Yeah. In the semifinal against Azarenka, Rybakina gets bageled in the second set and then manages to right the ship and wins in a tiebreak. Elena's serve got her out of a lot of trouble this week. It just looks like such an easy stroke. Everything about Elena's game looks so easy. And I think that's part of the reason people look at her and are like, okay, or find her boring, or she's not very emotive, of course. We saw maybe the most emotive you'll see her, which is a few spare complaints to her box.
She smashed a racket.
And that's a lot. But she just makes everything about her game look so easy. And even in the first set, toward the end of it, I was thinking, here we go. Like, here's where it turns, right? Danielle's in trouble. She saved, I think, four break points in not her final service game, but I think it was at 4-3. And at every one of those, it's like, okay, if Yelena does rest control of this match, we're in trouble. Because this power is so easy. Her serve can get her out of a lot of trouble. But it really, I think, exhaustion and everything did not allow her to put that together during the final.
You watch Danielle play close up, as I did courtside on Grandstand, and you get an appreciation of just how flat she hits the ball.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a whole lot of net clearance there. And you also get an idea of just how rhythmical her game is. A lot of her power is derived from being in good rhythm. And some of those cross-court backhand winners, chef's kiss.
Yeah. The story of the final was really just relentless power and aggression.
In fact, she won the tournament on a backhand, cross-court yes. backhand winner.
Yep. But you're right. I don't think you can tell on TV just how un-risk-averse she is. Just how risky her style of play can be. And she hit a lot of errors, of course. But the winners are so impressive.
One of the things that came out of Danielle's run this tournament was a discourse surrounding retirement. And specifically with Danielle, with this great result, will this change her mind? And she had very specific words to say to that question. We also see lots of folks online and on air say, oh wow, she's playing so well, I wish she'd reconsider it. Maybe this will spur her on to play more. And what Danielle is telling us is that, listen, this has been an incredibly painful few years, me trying to keep this tennis career going, and this decision to retire is tethered to my goals for myself personally, and it's a very personal decision. And so y'all are out here discussing it like it's free game, my life, my body, essentially. When I've answered this, I've dealt with it, I need you to respect my decision and just let it be.
Mm-hmm. I spoke about it at the Australian Open. First, of course, she just kind of dropped it out of nowhere. And of course, it was a surprise because she plays so well in Australia. She talked about it in Abu Dhabi. She's going to continue to be asked about it because regular sports people are going to look at her and say, wow, you're playing so well. Why would you ever leave this? When there are a million other reasons an athlete might choose to end their career. She has been dealing with rheumatoid arthritis and endometriosis, and she's been open about this with the press and about the severe pain it causes, the unpredictability of endometriosis, and the fact that there is no known prevention or cure.
And I get the impression that a lot of folks don't understand how painful and severe that is. It's almost as if people think, well, just deal with it. You're playing so well, just deal with it. Why wouldn't you?
Or maybe they had assumed, oh, you must have kind of figured this out because you're playing so well. The condition causes tissue similar to uterine tissue to grow outside of the uterus. And in 2021, she had an emergency surgery to remove a cyst. And these tissue growths and cysts cause incredible pain. And they cause scarring and inflammation in the pelvic area. And like I said, there is no cure to this. It's something that many, many women around the world just have to deal with. And imagine, for centuries, millennia, they were dealing with it and being told that it was all in their head.
That they were hysterical.
Because there was no diagnosis, right? Mm-hmm. We don't know what this thing is or why it happens. And still, women are told that. And still, Danielle is treated like... I don't think that... Well, I certainly don't. But I don't think a lot of people understand what the pain is or fully grasp like how threatening this could be, not only to one's career, but just their ability to live a happy, productive life.
In one of her press conferences, when she was asked about the prospect of continuing to play, she said, quote, I'm living with a chronic inflammatory disease that affects your ability to get pregnant. That's a deeply personal situation. I've explained that from time to time. I love coming out here and competing, but this is a really big life decision and that should be pretty understandable. Meaning I shouldn't have to keep explaining this to you all.
Right. So at this point, it's been spoken about. Stop asking. And back in February, she said her health wasn't even really the deciding factor in why she's ending her career. She said that she's eager just to get away from the grind of the tour and live a normal life. And she has talked about she's a homebody. She has dogs. Like, she likes being away from the spotlight. And she's 30 years old. She's been in the sport for decades at this point, not on the professional level. But for her, it's time. And that should be enough. I feel like Danielle has brought so much to the sport in a number of ways. So in one way is, of course, her openness about these health issues that impact women, that have impacted the course of her career, her personality, her unpredictability. She just has oodles of charisma. And then I think the unorthodox way in which she's led her career and sort of bucked what traditional sports people are supposed to be like and how they're supposed to approach their career. And I just feel like Danielle has brought so much color to our tennis watching experience.
Let me tell you, she looked like she'd been practicing for that trophy presentation because
Oh, yes.
She was giving pose after pose after pose, looking like a natural. we were rooting for Danielle to win this tournament, and on the men's side, we were rooting hard for Grigor Dimitrov to win this tournament. Found himself in the final, and with that, a guaranteed return to the top 10, number 9 regardless of the result, and had he won today against Jannik Sinner, he'd have moved to number 7 in the world. The first time he'd been back in the top 10 since 2018, at 32 years old.
Which, I'm told, is the third longest gap in history.
Mm. But he ran up against Jannik Sinner.
Well,
Grigor looked good for the first 2 to 3 games while Jannik found his footing, and then it was just one-way traffic.
It was. Jannik, his form at this moment is like he's doing everything right and he hits harder than you. You know, there were just so many incredible passing shots. Like, Grigor is trying his best to get to the net as much as he can. And in this, I mean, against players like this, it's hard enough even to get to the net. And then once you're there, you're getting passed. Like, this is not the era for that.
He hits with a lot of topspin, and then he can hit incredibly flat, and you can't push him back from the baseline because his movement and his speed is so elite right now, and he's beefed up the serve. Like, there are no weaknesses with Jannik Sinner. I guess you can still level up yourself if you're Carlos Alcaraz and the surface is conducive, such as it were in Indian Wells, which is Yannick's only loss on the year. But he's right back to where he was prior to that match.
Yes, yes. So we'll be moving to clay very, very soon. Jannik himself, in his speech today, said, well, I see this as an opportunity. You never know when this time will be your last time. We're moving to clay. Who knows what will happen? And that attitude, I'm sure, is probably very prosperous for him right now. I always caution, people said this about Carlos too, right? When Carlos was winning all those Masters tournaments and won the US Open, nobody can stop him. He's going to win 20 slams. And listen, we just don't know. We do not know what's going to happen, even in a year.
We're having a change of surface now. This will be a big tell.
Mm-hmm.
What's telling is that Sinner has made Medvedev his rabbit.
Wow. And what a turnaround. Because their head-to-head is still positive on Medvedev's side. He has a 6-5 record against Sinner. But the past, 8 months have been all Jannik.
Well, it was 2 sets to love in the Australian Open final for Medvedev. And then we all saw what happened there. And it's culminated this week to date. It could get worse. With Sinner winning 6-1, 6-2. Just completely blowing him off the court.
Yeah. This was a rematch of last year's Miami final, which Daniil won in straight sets.
Again, another tournament where Medvedev has not defended. Or even won for a second time.
Right. In their head-to-head, Jannik had not beaten Daniil ever until last August. And then he's reeled off the last 5. Grigor was such the feel-good player of the men's tournament this year, much like Daniel was on the women's side. Somebody who is well-liked by his peers, adored by gays, girls, and theys alike.
And the Kushners.
And the... No, listen, they like anybody who they view as famous.
In the middle of this run, I believe it was after the semifinal win, we see some kind of... Jared and Ivanka were there.
Yes.
And they're able to get a picture with Grigor after the match, and it starts circulating on Instagram.
Yeah.
That was foul.
And this guy, I don't know his name, but I looked at his Instagram, and he's clearly like a clout chaser who just hangs out with as many celebrities as possible.
Anyway.
The replies on that were wild, because all I tweeted was, U-M. You know, like, well, when Whitney said, sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you have to defend Grigor's integrity at all costs. He has to be 100% pure. There is absolutely no way that he knew what he was doing. Impossible to conceive. And the thing is,
I understand that famous athletes are put in these photo ops kind of against their will and just shuffled between people all the time. Famous and rich people will come down and take photos with you. I get that. However, we have been burned before overestimating the characters of famous athletes, have we not? At this big age that I have found myself, I don't assume anything. My cynicism for tennis players is like in the basement at this point.
Mm-hmm. Also, Grigor is besties with David Foster. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility.
The maestro of Mar-a-Lago? Yolanda Hadid's ex-husband?
Anyway, Grigor's run, he beat Tabilo in 3 sets. We were on site for that match. We actually thought about going in. That was when first got to tennis. You had just arrived.
We were actually at Vika and Peyton Stearns instead. I think the Tabilo match was ending.
That was on court one. And we thought about going in for the 3rd set, and we decided to stay with Vika instead. Because Grandstand was just so comfortable at that moment. Right.
And you knew, like, Tabilo Dimitrov was on a small court, and it was packed to the gills.
It wasn't that small. Court one is not that small.
Okay, well, it...
It was a smaller court.
Small because it was packed with South American fans.
Yes. And also, in that match, Grigor was down a set in a tiebreak in the 2nd set and down 5-2 in that 2nd set tiebreak. And when I saw that score, I was like, well, I'm not going to kill myself to get there to be disappointed.
Right.
But from that perilous position to start his tournament, he pulls that out in 3 sets, blitzes Yannick Hanfmann 6-1, 6-love, takes out Urkacz, the 2019 champion, or somewhere thereabouts.
That sounds right.
In 3 sets. Then the big win, the big, big win, beating Carlos in straight sets 6-2, 6-4, taking out that guy in 3 sets in the semis to get to Sinner in the final. Serena was at that semifinal.
Yes, sister Serena was at the final, or the semifinal, in the front row with her friend Damari. She was there for Yannick's match as well. And she was speaking to Yannick afterward, complimenting his forehand.
Oh, I wish I could hit my forehand as hard as you.
She is so unserious sometimes. But she, Miami Gardens is her backyard, essentially. I don't know exactly where she lives now. But she and Venus have lived in the area for a long time. This is like their hometown tournament. Always cool to see Serena. And she's supporting basically the other Williams brother, or the only Williams brother.
Grigor.
The rake of the Blackheart era, potentially. There's still controversy over whether Grigor was even Blackheart.
I'm sure there are a lot of people listening who haven't been following tennis as long as we have, who aren't as long in the teeth as we are, who may not know the Grigor thing.
I feel
the
like
Blackheart
that's,
thing.
Okay.
There are a lot of people who started following tennis within the last 10 years. It's not
okay.
Fathomable.
In 2012, Serena had this massive comeback. She wins Wimbledon. That summer, she won the Olympics and the US Open, beat Maria in the Olympic final. She had also first started working with Patrick, and she was in a reported romantic pairing with him. She gave this interview with Rolling Stone, and the reporter printed her quotes about this other player who is with a guy who has a black heart. And then she proceeded to talk trash about this other player. And it created this flame war between Serena and Maria, which is why I always say, no, the beef was very real. It may not be anymore, but it was at the time. And she said, you know, this player never gets invited to the cool parties. it was a wild time to be a fan. But Blackheart was reportedly Grigor, who had been linked in the media to both Maria and Serena. But there has been controversy ever since on whether Serena and Grigor were ever romantically linked, and if they were even talking about that.
How would we know?
Right. We don't know. But it has given us a great joke for the ages.
I mean, Serena has spent many years trying to upgrade Brett Ratner.
Oh. Well, it's not... wasn't that hard. Upgrade. Brett Ratner, who she literally dumped on MTV Diary while watching Venus play tennis.
Happy for Grigor. Congrats to Sinner. I'd say the other big piece of news that happened on the men's side was the absolute calamity, disaster that happened to Andy Murray.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you about that match, first of all, because you said you had tried to get in and I went over a bit later. In the third set, I went over to Butch Buchholz. Buchholz? I don't know how you say that.
They say Buchholz.
Okay. And I walked to the far side and I got in line. And it was early in the third set. I think it was before the first changeover. So I was thinking, okay, I'll be here a while. And there were a number of people in front of me. I had no designs on getting in. I just thought, I should give it a chance because it's Andy. This could be his last time here. There was almost a fight in the line when they opened the little gate thing. They were letting people in. And then, you know how it always is. It always like this. People are like, oh, those people back there are with me. Those two people there with me, they got to come to the front. I'm too old to fight about this. Fine.
You say that.
No. If it were a Serena match, that's another thing. But she would never be on Butch Buchholz. So people behind me start getting into it. And they're like, oh, those 14 people behind you are with me. And you know, just... And they were right. I mean, they were right. But there was almost like an all-out fight. And I'm like, I need to get out of here. I do not need to be catching stray punches or anything. It's not that important to me. And then the attendant says, I have room for two more. And still, I wasn't the first or second person in line. But the people who were trying to hold spots, they relented. And they were like, you know what? It's fine. I give up. And I got to go in. Got a nice seat right behind the baseline. Third set was pretty interesting, as you know. Andy goes down 2-5. He's scrapping. He's fighting to get it back. And the second, literally the second, he evens it to 5-all, he starts jumping up in extreme pain. From behind me, there, you know, people jumped up immediately celebrating the end of the game. And I couldn't really see. All I saw was him sort of bobbing up and down. And it looked like he was celebrating, evening the match. No. As all of you saw on TV, that's not what was happening. He was jumping up because he was in pain. He didn't want to land on his foot.
Because, in fact, it turns out he had ruptured every piece of ankle ligament that one can have.
Yeah. I did read, because I thought this was true, but I wanted to make sure. A rupture and a tear are the same thing. A rupture just describes a full tear of a ligament. He ruptured two ligaments in his ankle. He got it looked at. Then he went home to the UK to have it looked at. He still has not told us what type of treatment he will be pursuing and how long he'll be out. For this type of rupture, apparently that has the potential to be healed just through rest and rehab, or a keyhole surgery could be another option. We don't know what this means for the rest of the year for him. Will he make it to Wimbledon? Will he make it to the Olympics?
On social media, he said, yesterday, towards the end of my match in Miami, I suffered a full rupture of my ATFL, a near full thickness rupture of my CFL. I will see an ankle specialist when I return home to determine next steps. Goes without saying, this is a tough one to take, and I'll be out for an extended period, but I'll be back with one hip and no ankle ligaments when the time is right. Which is a remarkable attitude to have, considering he had been hinting pretty hard that this was going to be his final season on tour.
Having been there and not knowing the severity of the injury, it was devastating. It, you know, just seeing somebody fight this hard to get the match back on his terms and have a real chance to come back against Mahatch and then have it end in injury, that alone was devastating. But then to add this very serious injury to it, it's like, how much more can this one guy take?
Given that he was actually playing very good tennis.
Right.
At this tournament, he'd won a match, he had looked good in this match. Perhaps there was finally, at long last, some momentum building for him.
He did continue the match. He didn't even get his ankle wrapped or anything. He always does wear those braces. But looking back, he probably should not have continued the match. He managed to get it to a tiebreak and then lost in the tiebreak. You know, walked off and thanked everybody. It was a really sad thing to witness.
Before we move on to the negativity, with his performance in Miami, Grigor became the 9th active ATP player to have made the quarters of all 9 Masters 1000 tournaments. Can you name the other 8?
What? There's a test?
There's a test. The best tests are the ones that you don't see coming.
Oh, who said that? One of your teachers probably brainwashed you. Made the quarters of all the Masters tournaments?
Yes.
Okay, well, let's get the big four out of the way, minus Federer.
We're talking about active players.
Yeah, Murray, Nadal, Djokovic.
Yes.
Are all active, right?
That's three. You need five more.
So there's Zverev.
Yes.
Unfortunately. Medvedev?
No.
Oh, Madrid.
So there's four more.
Dominic Thiem?
Yes. Three more.
I'm trying to think of consistency. Rublev?
No.
No. I don't think so, actually. And Nishikori?
No.
Damn.
One of them is 37, I believe, going on 38.
Monfils?
Yes. Which leaves two more.
Alcaraz?
No. One of them you've mentioned a lot with all your drug stories that you love. Which top player caught a case? Which slam winning player has caught a case in the past?
Peter Korda?
No. That you've watched.
Oh, Marin Cilic.
Yes, and the final one is...
No, just tell me, because I'm done.
Is currently dating a WTA player.
There are a few. Oh, Stefanos.
Yes. Now, a week ago today is where and when this all went down. Last Sunday, we roll up for our final day on site. I had learned earlier in the week that if you didn't prepay for parking, which was $25, and you just rolled up to the site, they then charge you $40.
Right.
Now, if that isn't capitalism, I don't know what is. And so we had planned ahead, because we had rented a car, that we would obviously pay for parking ahead of time. We got a yellow lot assignment. Mm-hmm. We pull up to the site where one of us could have just hopped out and walked right to the main entrance at 12:10 p.m. We decided to get a later start because the only early match that we would have even wanted to see was Ben Shelton, and we deduced that on Grandstand, that probably would have been a shit show to try and get into. So why even bother? Let everybody else fight amongst themselves and we'll just roll up and we'll be good. No. So we rolled up to the site at 12:10, did not enter the Hard Rock grounds until 1:50 p.m. 100 minutes later.
Yeah, I thought yellow was the worst, but no. There were depths below the yellow parking lots. You have no idea. When we got there, it's like, no, yellow's full. Turn around.
The first yellow is full.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and then we got to, they say next, go to the next yellow. Next yellow is full, of course. Nobody is communicating. They got walkies, but I don't know what they're talking about.
And then they say, go to that yellow over there. But to do that, you have to turn left into an intersection that's taking you to the one parking lot over there or entering the turnpike.
Right.
It's literally right there. So people are either trying to get into that spot or trying to get on the turnpike. It's busy. And so we are stuck in an intersection, which, mind you, was incredibly dangerous, with cars coming from all four directions at a snail's pace, and it's just a lock jam.
So we're stuck there for like maybe a half hour. Hadn't we maybe moved like one or two car lengths the entire time? And time is ticking. You paid for a ticket, right? You paid for a day session ticket and you just see it going away. It's like, oh, Coco's match is over, so I guess we're not seeing her today.
But also, we paid for parking. Right. What did that get us?
And planned ahead.
All of a sudden, a car that is off diagonally to my right as the passenger, I see somebody get out. And I'm like, oh no. What is going on here? This person gets out and tries to direct traffic. And they go to this big pickup truck in front, which has a big American flag plastered on it. This dude who is driving it doesn't seem to be the most friendly dude. And he's very dismissive to this European-looking guy. And then that guy comes over to us and you roll down the window and he's like, can you just move back?
Well, no, he's speaking Spanish. And I'm like, fine, I'm in Miami. I'm on your turf. But I was like, I don't know.
Right, but he's trying to get you to move back like 5 inches. He's trying to part the Red Sea here.
Yes.
To get cars from four different directions to move inches so that this car can come through, go across, cut through, and get to the black parking lot. So when I'm seeing this happening, I'm like, I look at the car and I'm thinking, this is a tennis player. This guy is part of a tennis player's team. I look at the car and they're dressed like they're part of a tennis outfit. And eventually it works. Eventually, this dude is able to make it happen. And this Tesla, this white Tesla, just zoops right through. And when I tell you, I am 35% sure it was Casper Ruud.
Mm-hmm. You asked on Twitter, you gave the scenario, and you said, who do you think it was? Why did several people right off the bat say Casper Ruud?
Nobody said any other tennis player. No. I didn't say it was a man or a woman.
Nobody even went local.
Right.
Like an American player who lives in Florida. Nope, you went straight to Casper Ruud.
At least three people said, yep, it's Casper. As to why?
No, I know why. And we'll get to that in a moment. But he is not beating the Karen allegations. That's why. That's why.
It gets worse. Eventually, I get out of the car and I walk along the grass to see if somebody's actually directing traffic, because it had been unclear to this point.
Mm-hmm. They're telling you to make U-turns in the middle of these seven-lane roads with people going in all directions. Nobody gives a fine fuck about safety for cars or pedestrians.
A fine or flying?
Whatever.
So I get to the top, and I see that there is a woman directing traffic, and it starts to move now. People are getting into that yellow lot. I come back to the car. We get three cars from entering this yellow lot, and she starts directing people elsewhere. It's full. It's full. You can't go there. She sends you over to the black lot.
So if we didn't let Casper through, we might have gotten right there.
Sends us over to the black lot where Casper went, allegedly. And these people have no idea why these cars are now coming over here. And you're like, excuse me,
no,
that lady who is quite literally 20 yards away from you said, we need to come over here. And then that person says to somebody else, are we taking yellow right now? No, you have to go to Walmart.
Now I got to go to Walmart. And I had asked the lady, I said two times, so you're telling me that yellow is parking here now? In black. And she said, yes, yes, yes. They don't know what the fuck she's talking about.
Again, nobody's communicating via walkie-talkies. They have them, but nobody's doing that. This is 45, 50 minutes in now. We go toward Walmart. Full. Walmart's full. Eventually, we end up parking at a community center, which is still not really marked. We try to enter into...
Oh, no, after us... Okay, at this point, we have spoken to maybe like 8 or 9 people mm-hmm. who work there. And only the final person... was correct.
Well, that's because he was already at that location. It was just the wrong entrance.
Right.
So we have to turn back around, go enter somewhere else. And then they say, oh, there's a shuttle coming. Is it? Will it?
No, I said...
Am I taking that chance?
Not getting on a shuttle after all this.
And so, then with 40 people waiting for this shuttle, is there any guarantee that we are going to get on this shuttle? I doubt it's a Greyhound-sized bus. So we end up having to walk a mile each way.
A mile and a half.
To the stadium and then back to the community center. And so at 1:50, 100 minutes after we turned up on site, we are finally able to enter the stadium after having prepaid for parking. I can't think of, I mean, I guess because it happened to us, but this seems so emblematic of how shoddily run this tournament is.
And, I mean, it tells you a lot about Florida as well. Because if you've been to Florida, you know that it's a place that is incredibly hostile to pedestrians. Mm-hmm. The pedestrian infrastructure is non-existent. The cities are just not designed for people who walk. I mean, I was at that point, I was like, fine, I'm fine walking. Like, it's going to take 20, 25 minutes, whatever, we'll get there. It's not raining. You get to these major intersections and none of the lights work. So you're sort of guessing, when is it my turn to cross?
As a pedestrian.
Right. Then you get on site and the attendants, if you're on foot, they don't see you. Like, you do not exist. So they're letting cars through on your light. I'm nice now. Can you believe how nice I am? Because I am so Canadian in these spaces. I say sorry. I don't cuss anybody out. But some people deserve that.
You told me so many times, you should just get out and go.
No, I said, like, please get out because I'm going to lose it and right, you're going to be mad.
Right, but do you know why I didn't get out?
Why? Because I would have left.
I don't know what would have happened. There were, like, many scenarios that ran through my mind.
No, literally, I would have just left. And I sort of wanted to preface this. It's too late now. But I wanted to say, like, I know how privileged we are to go to these tournaments. And I know, like, how lucky we are to even be able to do it. And I don't want to be somebody who complains about these opportunities that we've been given. Because not everybody can do these things. But it was shocking, yeah. Y'all.
It's also a preamble and a precursor to what we're going to talk about with the actual running of this tournament.
Yeah. And the other reason that I felt free to speak the truth on here is because I emailed the tournament on Monday.
Okay, Karen.
Well, because I was like, in the car, I'm like, I'm not paying for this. Like, I'm not paying for this ticket. I'm going to go. I'm going to enjoy my day, which I did. I set that aside. I saw a lot of matches. I enjoyed my day thoroughly. But I'm like, I don't want to pay for this. So I emailed them right away. Haven't heard a damn thing. I forwarded my email again. And I said, I've been waiting on a response. I haven't heard anything. I tweeted them today. Because sometimes that works. Sometimes you get like, oh, send us a DM. But this is not a real company. This is at Miami Open. This isn't like American Airlines. You know what I mean? I have not heard anything. So I know a lot of people, a lot of powerful people are like, stop blaming James Blake. No, whack him again. Whack him again.
Bottom line is, it was an incredibly dangerous situation.
Yes.
It really was.
And so far, have not heard a single whisper of an acknowledgement from anyone who works at the tournament.
And if this is a football stadium, why aren't you equipped to deal with this parking situation?
Football stadiums seat, what, 50, 60,000 people? Like, be for real. Where do the cars go?
Like, it was unbelievable. Now, I know a lot of you are probably thinking, well, duh, you should have taken an Uber.
Well, that's what we'll do from now on. But from now on, do you think I'm particularly motivated to go to this tournament? No. And would I recommend it to other people? No. And try to sue me because I didn't lie one time.
Okay, I think we bear some culpability in us being first-time goers, and if we were to go again, we'd be able to do things better. So, for example, we thought of it as it's going to be heavy traffic, taking Ubers, it's probably going to be a lot of surge pricing. That probably is not the way to go. So instead, we stayed in Fort Lauderdale. We rented a car and we said we'd just drive in. We'd pay for the parking, whatever. Now we know. Now we know.
Now we know to pick another tournament, to be honest.
I had...
No, you know what? It's giving U.S. Open prices, but not a U.S. Open experience. And I'll just leave it at that.
Well, this is what it boils down to. Yeah. You are one of the biggest tournaments in tennis, and you're giving amateur at almost every turn. And then you have your tournament director out here responding to critiques as if...
Oh, the players are just hysterical.
Oh, he had just gotten broken. So I understand why he was mad that there weren't actual towels. And then to imply that, well, it was raining on Friday, so that's why there's a shortage of towels. Excuse me?
What?
It was raining, and so that's why we don't have as many towels as
actually, we it tracks because there was just across the board, a lack of problem solving. Like when things got difficult. Casper was complaining. The fact that Casper was complaining to the chair umpire was hilarious to me. Because what does he have to do with that? The chair was probably like, yep.
Who else is he going to complain to in that moment?
Well, and he even said, well, the players complain to the tournament and nothing happens. So basically, I'm putting it on TV.
You have the Hawkeye Live fiasco. Let's not forget about this. Play was interrupted multiple times because Hawkeye was down. And then you have a scenario where Hawkeye is allegedly up, but it's calling balls out that were in, balls that were in, that were out, all over the place. Kasatkina and Kirsteia were shook.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been saying for how long that Ostapenko is right. Hawkeye is a lie. But it's nice that James Blake has all of these defenders who are either his colleagues or our important people in the sport, our journalists saying, leave James alone. And it's like, okay, you had the Yale to ATP to tournament director pipeline. Do you not deserve a little of the criticism when something goes wrong at a tournament?
And let's be real. Is
this not your job?
Also, the pretty privilege.
Right.
Like, you can't go too hard at James because he's so beautiful.
No, it's just that he's one of us.
Wertheim was asked something about this on Twitter, and he quote tweets, and he prefaces his response by saying, James Blake equals max integrity. And relevance, Your Honor, to this situation. Nobody. What I'm seeing is a former tennis player who has a cushy job as a tournament director. And instead, all we hear every time with these tournaments is that it's such a hard job. You don't know just how many things are going on, how many moving parts. It's not his fault. But if it's not his fault, if he's not to bear culpability, then who?
Well,
you just send complaints to an email address and never get a response?
Won't respond to, like.
And so he says, in response to Casper, quote, he had just gotten broken and that's a frustrating time. So I get it. And no hard feelings. Well, I'm glad there are no hard feelings. I wish it had been handled in a different way. The best way, I love this, is to talk to me. Don't go on the court and rant and rave about it. Because why? That makes me look bad. That makes the tournament look amateurish. But I totally understand being a competitor, he was in the heat of the battle. No, maybe it was just an accumulation of frustrations that, despite what Danielle Collins said in her victory speech, that it was the most amazingly run tournament in the history of the world, that maybe there are a lot of improvements that need to be made at this tournament.
And maybe her experience was great. But sorry, it was Harvard, not Yale. I don't know that that makes a material difference. But yeah, the Wertheim thing was like, nobody was saying James doesn't have integrity. They were complaining about the tournament.
We're not saying he's a liar.
Because that's...
Or a cheat.
It's just the kind of discourse that attempts to lock off any conversation. Don't talk about this guy because he's great. Like, well, you took the job. And if you don't want the job, if you feel other people should be accountable for the things the tournament messes up, the tournament should hire people who are qualified.
Also, I think it's also about, I know this person, I don't want to hurt his feelings.
Yes, of course.
Which then gets into the conflicts of interest in tennis that are abundant. You know, like you can't critique something fully without caveat, because this person, I work with them here, and I may see them there, and I'd like to maintain access there.
I mean, IMG was trying to sell this thing off very recently, so I just don't know if their heart's in it.
Let me tell you, I walked into that stadium, and I was shocked, honey. I was in tears almost. No. And it had a white refrigerator.
Mm-hmm. That's what it was giving, yeah.
A few et cetera stories before we get into that story that we've been promising to talk about with the USTA and the sexual assault lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
First up, Dominic Thiem, he issued this video where he said, I just want to have you hear it from the horse's mouth because I don't want all this, you know, mix up in the media. At the start of the year, he was practicing much harder, much like he did at the start of his career where he had all his success. Since he came back from the wrist injury, he had been dialing back his practices, and he thought with his dad that maybe to get back to where I was, we need to ramp things up. A lot more strokes in practice, go harder. But then he said toward the end of that process, he started to have those same clicks in his wrist that he had when he first came back from the injury, and that led to a bit of pain. Said that he was still hoping to return to tour in Estoril. As of right now, he's still scheduled to do so. He's in the draw, and we'll see how that turns out. But that is not very comforting news.
Mm-hmm.
He said he's since had to dial back his practices. And this comeback continues to be all sorts of fraught for him.
We saw Layla play Jesse Pegula on the grandstand at Miami. And I realized kind of again that Layla is one of those players who I will always seek out if I get to see them live. And it doesn't, for me at least, doesn't necessarily translate to TV.
Same.
I won't necessarily watch her matches on TV.
Same.
But watching her in person is exciting. And
people love her in person, too.
Yes, people that's part of it, is that there's a lot of energy around her. And I think people just respond to her creativity in person. She lost to Pegula after putting up a pretty good fight. And then she went on her Instagram Live and was crying. And first of all, that wasn't a bad loss. You lost to the number 5 player in the world. I feel terrible that you're crying on Instagram, but mm-hmm. I want to just be like, girl, it wasn't bad.
And then there are folks who say, well, it just shows how much she cares. Okay, and what if she didn't?
Right.
You know, like, I mean, I almost admire the people who don't give a shit. about sport and tennis as their careers even more. You know, like, I treat this as my job. I'm going to show up. I'm going to put in the hard work. And when I'm done, I leave my work at work. And my home life is different. Those lines get blurred so easily in sport, in professional sport. Easier said than done, which is why I kind of appreciate it. But it is tough to watch Layla in those moments when she's given a good account of herself be so emotional about it. I mean, you lost to a top five player.
Right.
Lost to one of the very best players in the world. And perhaps, this is speculation, but perhaps with injuries that she's had and the massive success she had so early in her career and the expectations for her, the cumulative toll of that, not being able to translate that expectation into consistent results, that must be tough.
Oh, totally. And as always, let people cry if they want to cry. There's no wrong time to cry, you know? Novak and Goran Ivanišević are splitting. Novak announced this on his socials this week. And it's a part of a just kind of a strange period in Novak's career, having lost to Jannik at the Australian Open and then pulling out of Miami after losing in Indian Wells. And of course, people are speculating, is he like winding things up? Is his mind and heart in the sport right now? And I don't know. Clay will, I think, tell us a whole lot about where he is professionally.
Maybe he just needs a break.
Sure.
I don't know. He's earned it.
Mm-hmm. This past week, The Athletic reported that the original Saudi proposal to take over tennis is off the table. We literally just talked about this on the last episode, and I remember saying things are changing very, very quickly. The bid that we've been told is going to win is not necessarily going to win. It's very unclear right now what's going to happen with tennis.
And this is likely because the story went public, the proposal went public, and the Saudis are mad, and now they have to deal with competition.
And just like that, there's now a bidding process for this additional Masters event, which would most likely take place in January. And they're getting bids from UAE, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and even Tennis Australia. This is, if Craig is going to get a Masters shoehorned into January, Craig Tiley wants it in Australia, because it's threatening the pre-Australian Open schedule. But after the meetings in Indian Wells, which were just, 2 weeks ago, most of the tennis media was reporting that it looks like the Saudi plan is going to win out. And that was the plan that was backed by the ATP head, Andrea Gaudenzi. Now it's a lot less clear. But the big thing that I think I didn't realize from that first round of reporting is that the Premier Tour, which was the proposal put together by the Slams, does not have financing yet. And that's why I was like, well, how can that plan win if it hasn't proposed how they're going to pay for it?
This is going to be unfolding. It's probably going to be one of the stories that we talk about from episode to episode, because there'll be new leaks. Somebody will be mad this week. Somebody will try and inveigle their way into the situation that we hadn't even heard about before.
Mm.
So let's table it for now. The story that we've been kind of teasing for a few episodes and haven't gotten around to because we just run out of time on the episodes is this USTA story. Last year, we talked about depositions taking place in a case brought against the USTA by Kylie McKenzie, a former junior player who was sexually assaulted by a coach at a USTA training center in Florida. And this happened when she was 19. In February, a federal judge ruled that the USTA had been negligent in failing to protect McKenzie from the coach. And the judge upheld the idea that the USTA shares a, quote, special relationship with players, even if they're not children, much like a duty of care. And this creates an obligation to protect players. The judge denied requests from the USTA to prevent a jury trial. And why this story is coming back to the fore again is because allegedly there has been an attempt on the part of the USTA to prevent Pam Shriver from testifying at this trial.
Not alleged, actually. It is in the court filings. Early in March, the USTA said that Shriver's conversations with the USTA lawyer, which I'll expand on in a second, that those conversations should be inadmissible because Pam Shriver had no direct knowledge of the McKenzie case. And this was in a filing to the judge. We talked about this last year. Pam testified that Stacey Ellen Michelle, who is a lawyer for the USTA, followed her to her car after a meeting and told Pam to, quote, be careful. And there are two different sort of interpretations of this conversation between two people. Michelle, the lawyer, said that she was warning Shriver to keep her distance from Mackenzie's lawyer because he was, quote, not a nice person. But on Pam's side, she said, you know, when you're followed to your car and you're told by a lawyer to be careful, how would you interpret that, right? Is that of just be careful, like, don't get into this?
But why
is
would,
that a threat?
Why would Pam need to be told to be careful? Pam is a formidable figure in tennis, one of the most prominent players in tennis, somebody who clearly knows how to handle her business.
Yes. And throughout this, Mackenzie's lawyer has publicly accused the USTA of belittling, embarrassing, and intimidating survivors. In response to that filing, where they tried to get Pam's testimony thrown out, the judge on this case wrote, Michelle's approach and message to Shriver certainly looks like an untoward attempt to intimidate her and may be construed by the jury as being aimed at silencing victims of abuse by coaches. That is unequivocal. I cannot imagine as a lawyer how you thought that was ever a good idea. To have a private conversation where there were no witnesses but you and the other person who is testifying in this case and telling her to be careful.
Well, they didn't think that Pam would say anything.
Right.
That she, oh, well, you know.
Oh, well, yeah. There are no witnesses.
That makes sense. I'll definitely do that. The USTA says in a statement that they have never denied Mackenzie's allegations that she was assaulted, but they maintained that they were not liable. They fired the perpetrator soon after Mackenzie reported the abuse. His name is Anibal Aranda.
But one of the reasons that the judge still finds the USTA liable here is that during the course of the investigation, they found that a USTA employee had said Aranda groped her in 2015, but she didn't report it. Since this person worked for the USTA, the judge sees that as the organization knowing that the person was a problem and not taking action before Kylie Mackenzie was assaulted. This has huge implications across sport. There's a reason the USTA is fighting this so hard, because it speaks to the extent to which sporting agencies are responsible for the actions of coaches, often at far-flung outposts of their organization. Right? This wasn't at the USTA headquarters, but it was at a USTA facility where this happened. This case will go to a jury trial, and stay tuned because it's pretty massive in terms of how this sport treats accusations of sexual abuse.
That brings us to the end of episode, what is it, 338?
I think so, yeah.
We will be heading to Charleston in a couple days.
Yep.
We'll be there Wednesday, Thursday, Friday next week on site. I'm looking forward to you experiencing the Althea Gibson Club Court personally.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I don't oversell it.
I'm looking forward to a smaller tournament and a WTA-only tournament, mm-hmm. definitely.
I know we had a lot of negative stuff to say about the Miami tournament, and you even said you'd never go back. I'm not of that opinion. I still had quite a lot of fun, especially on the outer courts. Grandstand was wonderful. Did you enjoy Butch Buchholz?
I mean, I was only there for like 45 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a great atmosphere because it was Andy.
Yeah, and also we didn't really struggle to get into any of the outer courts. There were never really lines wrapping all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of positives, I think. It's just that one day was shocking.
No, definitely. I had a really good time overall mm-hmm. and saw like a lot of great tennis. It's just, you know, you just can't get that like feeling out of the back of your throat of being, of paying a lot of money for, I don't know how to describe it.
What you're trying to say is we didn't feel we got our best bang for buck with this tournament.
No, I just felt like we were treated like shit.
Oh.
You know?
Oh.
And all of the other people around us. I don't know if those people complained, but, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like, okay, now I'm here. Now I'm going to spend $30 Canadian on a drink. Like, I didn't feel like, oh, I'd really want to part with my money now.
Mm. I also think our experience was affected unusual by your last minute decision to come. I think it
Oh, I mean, I'm sure it would have been better if I didn't come. Is that
No. I'm just saying I think we could have planned things better if you were coming from the jump, if you weren't so resistant to me, as usual, being right about how you should live your life and the decisions you make.
Listen, we were not planning a tennis trip to Mars, okay? Like, it shouldn't have required that much planning.
Anyway, thanks for listening. My name is Jonathan. You can find me on Twitter at @tennis_John.
And I'm James at @ElliotJMR.
Two L's, two T's. You can find everything BodyServe related at linktree.com/thebodyserve. Thanks for listening.
Till next time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.